As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Good morning, everyone. Bloomberg Surveillance, David Gura and Tom Keene in New York. We're going to go to a most important interview. Good morning to all of you of Global Wall Street. And David, this really frames out the struggle for all of investment, conservative, boring mutual fund managers, everyone in every flavor of hedge fund. And you see it when I quote the VIX 10.71. Or we look at foreign exchange VIX, we look at fixed income volatility, the dampening and quiet of the market is challenging for everyone. In conversations at Cantor Fitzgerald on September 11th in that charity event, you talk to the people in the trenches, and I'll tell you, David, it's a trade-to-trade of quiet through 2017.
Hugh Henry joins us now from our studios in London. The manager of Eclectica Asset Management, announced in a letter yesterday that fund closing after 15 years. Great to have you with us here on Bloomberg Surveillance. Appreciate the time this morning. Let's just start with the motivations for doing this, the complexity, the global complexity that led you to make this decision, and tell your investors this yesterday.
There was absolutely no complexity. I'd like to think in my life I've done things differently. I don't want to sound like Frank Sinatra. My message is I died in active combat, if you will. I died having a go. I think what we've seen, a lot of my contemporaries, were rich, were tired, were fed up, and just kind of, you know, slipped out the back door. I wanted to go out with a bang, if you will, and I wanted to go out saying, I see the world, it's huge, I have these trades, I'm here, and I think you're missing this, let's have this dialogue. Just the economics, and there's nothing complex. Economics were against me.
Hugh, good morning. Wonderful Hi, for Tom. You to come on with us. Global Wall Street, listening to you now across all of our radio. You said to Lionel Barber's rag 5 years ago, we're harshly disciplined by market trends. You will never see us pursue a homegrown idea to the detriment of the prevailing trend. The trend hasn't been there with a dampened vol across all asset classes. Are you a victim of the dampening of Janet Yellen, John Carney, Mr. Kuroda, and Mr. Draghi?
Far from me to play my violin and claim to be a victim. But certainly, I believe there are wider forces to play, because this is not a story about individuals. This is a generic story about a great group of some of the most provocative and fantastic brains in the world, who as a group since 2012 really have consistently failed to produce returns.
Well, but I made the key distinction this morning, Hugh, and I think this is critically important in the mathematics of failure. You didn't blow up. I mean, you're down 9% this year. I get that. But you didn't blow up. This is a sequence of, frankly, good subpar returns. How do we end that and get back to alpha generation or alpha loss? I mean, somebody loses. But how do we get back to so-called normal, where the game is fair when you wake up in the morning?
Well, I'm not arguing that the game is unfair. I would actually say that global macro enjoyed a moment in time which where the fortunes and the great performance of the protagonists perhaps owed much to the context I believe that, you know, we had that inflation drama in the 1970s, and for at least three decades, if not 40 years, it remained long in the market memory, if you will, that we could return to such an environment. It was also there with the Fed. I mean, remember, as early as back in the taper tantrum of 2013, the Fed was proposing to tighten its policy with the national unemployment rate at 7.5% and with no credible sign of inflation. We've just been on this high alert. Now, the result of that has been that for decades, the real return on US Treasury bonds were very, very high. And the macro model was simple. You come in, you leverage those returns, you get a very high risk-adjusted return. It pays for the commercial cost of running the business, and it pays for taking, buying convexity via puts on fixed income or equity markets. And periodically, they go in your favor, and everyone thinks you're a rock star. Mm. Now, quantitative easing now, I estimate that 10-year real Treasury bond yields are 0.3%. So even leveraging that, which I wouldn't advise because they seem expensive, you know.
Well, that's where we are. When do you envision the young kids, CFAs, when do they get to play again? Because we've seen X number of years of this dampened idea. When does the game get fun again?
Well, the game gets the game will get fun again. But I think I always look at the irony and the paradox of the path that the world chooses to take. It will become relevant again because there will be a moment when people will call upon diversifying assets. They will discover to their great horror that their U.S. treasuries are not doing the job. And so they'll be calling upon global macro, but they'll be looking at their allocation. They'll be saying, we used to say, where are all the customers' yachts? We'll be saying, where are all the macro managers? Now, you might retort on the yachts, but, you know, we're de-skilling a portfolio diversifying subsector.
Yeah. Hugh, don't be a stranger when you're in New York. When you take the Concorde, Hugh's the only one still taking the Concorde. When you take the Concorde over your private Gulfstream, please stop by in New York. We'd love to talk to you for a longer conversation or when we're in London. Mr. Hendry, shutting down his hedge fund yesterday, really major global news for Global Wall Street, David. I really can't convey enough. He didn't blow up. That's the news here. He didn't blow up. It was just the dampening. I can honestly say I've never seen this, David.
There you go. Invoking Frank Sinatra. Regrets, I've had a few. Hugh Hendry, great to speak with him exclusively here on Bloomberg this morning on the heels of that news. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. David Gura and Tom Keene in New York, coast to coast and worldwide. Ben Cardin has been in the U.S. Senate since 2007. Before that, he represented the 3rd District in Maryland in the U.S. House of Representatives. He is now the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He joins us now on our phone lines on a day when we are keenly focused on what's happening in the Pacific. Of course, another missile test last night by North Korea, an intermediate-range ballistic missile, shot a distance farther than the distance between North Korea and Guam, a protectorate that country has threatened several times. Now, Senator Cardin, great to speak with you. I look at the president's schedule today. Your colleague on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, is going to be meeting with the president today. I wonder if you have any insight into what the two of them will be talking about, and if you could tell us a bit about the kind of interface you've had with this administration on issues like these thus far.
Well, first of all, good morning, and I'm certain that Senator Corker will be talking about North Korea as one of the subjects on the agenda with the president. I've had discussions with members of the Trump administration on North Korea and other issues, but clearly this most recent test confirms the fact that North Korea not only has the nuclear weapon, but they are developing the means in which it could be delivered, not just in the region, but beyond the region. So it's a matter of it's extremely dangerous, and it's an urgent issue for the United States to change its game plan from the point of view of, I believe, starting a diplomatic surge working with China to change the equation.
As you watch all of these tests, and I think there have been 13 or 14 of them this year alone, do you regard them as tests, as North Korea trying out or showcasing technology they've developed, or are these simply provocations to you? How do you view them?
I believe that they want to have a functional nuclear arsenal that is capable of reaching the U.S. and our allies. They look at this as an ability to prevent the United States from affecting their regime. But you never know how these weapons could be used. It's a regime that's unpredictable. It violates international law. So our objective is to prevent North Korea from destabilizing the region in our interest. And that means freezing and hopefully eliminating their nuclear weapon program.
Senator Cardin, good morning. I think Maryland is possibly the most misunderstood state in the country. Cumberland, Maryland, 138 miles away from your Baltimore, went 70% plus vote for President Trump. When you travel out to Western Maryland, what do you see as the reaction to the follies of your Washington over the last 200-300 days? What's the response? You, as a diehard Baltimore Democrat, what do you see in Republican Maryland?
Well, you know, Maryland is called America in miniature. We have the mountains of Western Maryland. We have the beaches of Eastern Shore. Clearly, the western part of our state is more politically conservative than either the Baltimore or Washington regions, which is much more progressive. The western part is traditional conservative areas of our state. They're good people.
Have they wavered? Have they wavered on the president?
I think if you deal with the issues, they're certainly disagreeing with a lot of the policies that have been proposed by the Trump administration, and they are certainly against a lot of the language the president has used. Whether that would translate into votes that would vote against the president, I don't know. But I do believe there is disagreement with the manner in which the president is conducting his affairs.
Senator Cardin, you're going to get through the weekend. On Tuesday of next week, there's a nominations hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Honorable John Huntsman is going to be sitting down taking questions from you and your colleagues. He, of course, nominated to be the next ambassador to Russia. How much is his nomination clouded by the scandal involving Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election? And what questions do you have for him about how he's going to move forward if, in fact, he's confirmed?
Well, Mr. Huntsman is well qualified to be ambassador to Russia. He is a person who's well respected by both Democrats and Republicans. I'm pleased that he's willing to allow his name to come forward. My guess is that the confirmation hearing is going to focus more about our challenges with Russia than the qualifications of Mr. Huntsman. The U.S.-Russia relationship is extremely important, and it is very challenged today.
I bring up that nomination. That's a high-level one for a big ambassadorship. When you look at the names the White House is putting forward, how worried are you about how few of them you've seen thus far? Are you getting any indication here that the White House is going to be moving faster to fill some of the vacant positions that still exist in Foggy Bottom?
I am extremely concerned by the slow pace of filling critical positions at the State Department. I'm not alone. Democrats and Republicans have voiced our concern. Well, just talking about North Korea, we don't have an assistant secretary for that region. So we don't have the people in place that can give a clear direction to U.S. policy in so many parts of the world. So it's not just our ambassadors in important countries. It's key positions within the State Department that are political appointments subject to confirmation by the Senate that haven't been filled.
It's Friday, so I'm allowed to do gossip, Senator Cardin. I'm absolutely fascinated by who's sitting on the couch in the Oval Office. Do the Democrats have the back of Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi? Do they have the support of not common sense Democrats like Cardin of Maryland, but the other rabble? Are they in support of the two?
Oh, absolutely. We very much want our political system to work, and the only way it's going to work is with Democrats and Republicans all being involved. So we applaud our leaders' willingness to sit down with President Trump and to work out solutions. The DACA children, we need to protect the Dreamers, and it's one of our highest priorities among the Democratic caucus. We were pleased to see that we didn't have a default on our government debt. We want to see a budgets passed. We want to keep government open. So, look, we were disappointed by the election, but we wanted to make sure that our system works, and Democrats need to be part of the process.
Senator, I was medicated coming in this morning because I had to watch Orioles baseball last night. Come on. Would you guys do like a public grant to help Mr. Showalter out? Man, he can't hit the ball. Come on. When does this turn around for the dreaded Baltimore Orioles?
Well, you know, we've had ups and downs during the season. There's been some stretches that we thought we were going to be the world champions, and we're not giving up hope yet. We're still in the pennant chase, and but it's been a very disappointing 2 weeks, no question about it. And we love our Orioles. We just wish they were flying a little higher.
They play in the most gorgeous modern ballpark. Senator Cardin, thank you so much. Senator for the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah. Great to speak with him again, the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Incredibly timely interview. Grateful to have him taking the time on this busy Friday morning to talk to us about North Korea in particular.
David, there are those states, like I think of Georgia North South, that span geography. Maryland is remarkable over a short distance from the West. On Sirius XM to Baltimore, 99.1 FM, Baltimore, Washington. This is Bloomberg.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
We had one solitary guest this hour, and he brought an entourage with him. Why don't you attempt an introduction, David?
Yeah, Curran? I'm gonna run down the list. We got Mark Lastry with us, JB Dine, and Wes Edens as well here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York. And I don't know who to begin with here. Let's start with Wes, if we could, Tom, and I'll let you follow up from here. Let me just get your sense of sort of where things stand from an investment perspective right now, where there's the greatest opportunity as you see it, and just to maybe outline, if you could, some of the challenges of being an investor right now.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having us. You know, I think the environment right now from an investment standpoint is pretty tough. You know, you've had a long period of very low interest rates, and you've got pretty good growth in the U.S., notwithstanding kind of lots of challenges. But there's not a lot that is obviously cheap, you know, so it's a time to pay attention to what you're doing.
This is a four-hour interview.
That's right.
We've got three guys in the studio. Can I get in here, David? Mark Lassie, I've been dying to talk to you about the follies of Washington. How did you enter America? Were you like on a – you didn't go through Ellis Island, right?
No, I didn't.
Come through JFK?
Probably, yeah, JFK.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, you're Moroccan. You come into the country. You're the definition of success of immigrants. What do you think of what's going on in Washington with DACA and with the debate over rich or poor immigration and the rest?
Look, I think, I mean, for me, it's probably a little bit more sensitive, but I think at the end of the day, you know, this country was made on immigrants, and what's going on today is a bit ridiculous over all this stuff. So, you know, you would hope that people would be able to solve this issue on DACA.
You came out of one of the coolest schools on the East Coast, Clark University. Would you have to go back home now? I mean, I guess you were in the U.S. then, but think of the immigrants that are going through top flight engineering schools. And am I right? They got to go home now?
Well, they do. I mean, good news is I got naturalized, so I guess for me it's okay. But ultimately, at the end of the day, for all these people who are at school, they'd have to return.
JB Dine, let me turn to you. We have a wide-ranging conversation here. Obviously,
they thought this was on basketball.
It was going to be on basketball. Yeah. Well, let's go there if we could. And this is something of particular fascination for me. We've seen the sale here of the Houston Rockets recently for an extraordinary sum of money. Help us understand how you value a basketball team. You're here, the three of you, investors, owners of a big NBA franchise. What does a sale like that mean for how you assign a value to an NBA franchise? Jamie, sorry.
Oh, me?
Others can chime in.
Well, I think
we're blocked by giant monitors
city.
As well. Yeah,
we can get flooded. No, you know, it's, you know, what's at the end of the day, what's really happening is really a few things. One is the modern NBA game is probably as exciting, if not the most exciting, I think, sports thing to watch. And as a result, viewers are watching it. Kids are watching it. Millennials are watching it. The world is watching it. I think it's probably, you know, the most popular, you know, big type, you know, sport, like in China, for example. And after soccer, it's the number two sport in the world. That's really number one. And as you look at what's happening with money for sports, okay, money for entertainment. It's really live sports that basically is the one thing you cannot watch the next day, don't want to watch the next day. You don't, you know, want to basically deal with the so-called cord-cutting risk. You have to watch it, you know, live. Yeah. So there's real value there. And then lastly, quite frankly, is I think there's a lot of people who love these, you know, teams. You know, I would say of all my investments I've ever done, and I think Mark and Wes would agree, this is by far the most fun investment we've ever
done. You had more fun at DLJ a few years ago, right?
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. Wes Eaton's, Mark Lasry, and Jamie Dinan with us. You know, we're going to mix it up. Literally, folks, we could go worldwide here for 4 hours with these three guys. They've got such great experience and individual and distinct experience. Jamie, let me start with you. You were in the DLJ Orange Book years ago, right? Elliot Platt would write the Maroon Book for DLJ on fixed income, right? And you had the whole thing going. Can you tell a kid today to go into Global Wall Street, given MiFID II, given the battle over research? Can you tell some kid coming out of Pennsylvania like you did, can you tell him to go into finance, be like Mark Lasry?
Absolutely, if it is your passion. Okay, yeah. I remember when I went into Wall Street, and it was 1981, my first job paid me $22,000 a year. It was a decent salary, but it wasn't like, you know, the kind of numbers you're hearing about today. And I went in because I was passionate about it. I actually wanted to do it. If this is a career that you're passionate about, you really want to do, you should do it. I think it's still a good career. Okay, if you're going to get rich, I wouldn't do that. If you're going to because you want to make something that you're actually going to enjoy doing and actually do well, absolutely.
Let's see, let me ask you about infrastructure in particular. We came out of the election, headed into inauguration with a lot of talk about there being a big infrastructure spending package, there being a renewed policy focus on infrastructure in this country. I know this is something you're keenly interested in as an investor. Are you convinced we're going to see something? How essential is it, in your estimation, that we get Washington to play some sort of catalytic role here, to provide some sort of package that's going to renew focus on infrastructure in this country?
I think it's critical. You know, I think that the returns on infrastructure are, you know, multiplier effects. I think when you have grid infrastructure, it actually is the kind of bedrock of a lot of economic activity, so it's really important, and there's lots and lots of need for it in the country. I think there will be something out of Washington, hopefully by the end of the year or the first part of next year, and I don't know what they're gonna say and how effective it's going to be, but I think it's desperately needed.
What could be most effective? I've listened to the presidency talked about this, and you see it sort of ebb and flow what he focuses on, and he's talked about infrastructure some. He was out in Ohio talking about it and the merits of more public-private partnerships. Is there a policy tool or something in particular that you think would be more effective than others at boosting investment in infrastructure?
Yeah, I think it's very, very clear. I think that the essential thing to provide is a mechanism for private capital to fund a lot of it. And so, and really the missing link in the capital structure for a lot of this is debt. So I think the government can be a debt provider, not cost the government a lot of money, and I think they can then enable a lot of private and direct investment, and I think that you could really see a tremendous boom in it.
To the three of you, and jump in here if you want, we just got off the phone with Hugh Hendry out of Scotland over in England. He's shutting down his hedge fund today, and I made a key distinction here. He didn't blow up. A lot of people blow up. We all blow up. I made mistakes. Everybody else has made mistakes. The three of you, I'm sure, have your war stories as well. He was killed by just dampened volatility. You know, he's down 9% this year. Fine. But all the rest of the returns was just the single digitness. Mark Lasry, to begin with you, is that where we are now, is perpetual single digitness? Or can we actually get back to making alpha within the industry?
Look, it's hard. I mean, the biggest issue that's out there today is pretty simple. The risk-free rate is sort of zero.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, when if you just look at 10 years ago, the risk-free rate, if you left your money in the bank, was 4%. So if you did 4 or 5 times the risk-free rate, you were fine. You were at 20. Here today, you do 4 times or 5 times the risk-free rate. Let's just say it's 10 bips. You're making 50 bips. So you're taking a lot more risk. It's what Wes said. I mean, it's just you're in a much, much harder environment. And because of that, you're taking a lot more risk, and you're going to end up having, in my opinion, fewer and fewer people who do what we do, because, you know, people aren't going to tolerate the lower returns.
Wes, quickly, is this dampening because of central bank policy? Is it as simple as that? I asked the same question to Hugh.
I think if you had to pick one thing, you'd say, yeah. I mean, I think that it really keeping rates low as they have been, as long as they have been, while it might have been a great idea you know, in the middle of the financial crisis. The financial crisis has been over for a long time, and I think that's a real challenge. It really is. And this low rate that Mark talks about, that actually is what drives then all other related returns, and that's what makes the challenges, I think.
Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. David Gura and Tom Keene in New York here with a packed house in our Bloomberg 11302s.
Mark Lashley, Jamie Dimon-Wesley.
You got your seat back, Tom. Yeah. You should take it away. Go for it here. Packed house here with some questions.
So many things to speak of, but I think it would be unfair to speak to Mr. Dine and Mr. Lassery and Mr. Edens and not speak about basketball and television in that. We're all fixated by Cleveland and Boston and this and that and the stories on the West Coast. I guess there's a team, David, on the West Coast that's pretty good. I can't remember. But is the gravy train going to continue, that thing? Is one of you three the TV expert of the three at West?
Yeah.
Is the party going to continue for you that is TV sports?
Well, it's live sports is very, very valuable, right? It's what everyone wants to watch, and even the cable cutting and whatnot, you still want to watch live sports. Now, the old media companies, I think, are struggling, and the new media companies are in the rise. So I think the answer is that the content, very valuable, going to continue to be valuable, more valuable perhaps. The nature of how it's distributed, I think, could change a lot in the next 5 years.
It will change in distribution, but will it port over to the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Googles? I don't understand how I watch the Bucks on a little itty-bitty computer screen like you do on the big 4K Sony. I mean, I can't get there. Help me get there.
You might be a little too old. It's conceivable. It's. I think that people consume.
Oh, you think that's funny, girl?
I think people consume the sports in a lot of different ways. And I think what's going to happen though is that unquestionably it's going to be distributed many different ways. You know, you saw the big announcement from Disney on the streaming product, and we haven't really figured out how to monetize it properly as an industry, but it's coming. And it's coming fast.
Mark Lashley, let me just ask you about your audience, the Bucks' audience right now, obviously incredibly important to that city itself. But how cognizant are you? How cognizant are all three of you about the national, the international reputation of the brand? What's the focus there?
Well, I actually think we're America's team. I mean, I think if you forget about everybody else, if you look at
Knicks were.
I know, but it's not the Knicks.
No,
I think because of Giannis and a number of the other players that we have. It is an international team, right? And because of that, you could be anywhere. My daughter was on her honeymoon in Greece, and she was wearing a Milwaukee Bucks T-shirt, and everybody just keeps running up to her, why are you a fan of Giannis? And she was like, yeah, I love Giannis. I mean, I think wherever you are, especially for our team and where you've got international players, I think it's huge.
How about the issue of legalized gambling? I don't know who would take a bite out of this, but Adam Silver talks about the need to have a better mechanism in place for that. Mark, I'll have you take a bite of it if you want, and y'all can jump in if you want. Do you think that's going to happen? Is there a lot of money to unlock there? Do you think we're going to get some sort of legalized system within the context of the NBA for legalized gambling?
Look, my view is you should have it. I mean, it happens. So we can stop making believe it doesn't happen. And I think Adam's right. I think sooner or later it will end up becoming legal. And once it does, I don't know what ultimately happens, but I'm sure as people are betting, there will be ways for people
formalized
to figure out.
Yeah.
I don't pretend to be an expert, but you went inside, is this right for the GM, the new GM? You had one guy go to Orlando, and you tell me about that decision. I mean, the pressure to spend huge money to go outside. Why did the Bucks stay internal to pick up the guy that's got to keep the egos in check?
Well, we ran a very robust process to look at a lot of people, and in the end, we concluded that.
David, did they call you? They can call you.
Well, it wasn't quite that robust.
No, not that robust.
But we ran a very robust process. We talked to a lot of people, and we concluded at the end that the guy that worked for us was the best candidate. Mm. So it was that simple, and we're very happy with them. But big decision.
Mark, just circling back to something Tom asked you about a few moments ago, that being hedge funds. We had this conversation with Hugh Henry just a little while ago, and what we didn't talk about was fees, and he said he's thrown in the towel, not going out with the disappointedly. Is the conversation about fees an ancillary conversation? He said that we're seeing the end of a global macro moment. How much readjustment has to happen with fees and hedge funds, and is that going to be something that saves hedge funds here going forward?
Look, I don't think people mind paying fees, to be perfectly blunt, if you're giving them the returns, right? At the end of the day, what gets people upset is if you're charging them 2 and 20 and you're flat or you're up 1 or you're up 5, right? It's the 2
or,
and
or 20, down 10.
Or down 10, yes. That's what gets people upset. Yeah. It's not. So fees become a big part when you sort of look at it and say, all right, the 10-year, which is a little bit of what Wes said, sure. If the safest investment is a treasury and a 10-year is 2% and you're charging somebody 2%, that's kind of tough. You know, it's just math. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day,
it comes down to that.
Yeah, that's all it is.
We just got 40 seconds left. Jamie Dimon, let's go back to the acclaimed Elliott Platt of Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette a few years ago. He never had to deal with negative rates.
Just a few years
How do
ago.
The three of you survive when you got a German 2-year down negative 70 beeps and a Swiss 20-year at, I can't remember what it is, 15 pounds? Just quickly here, when do the negative rates ballet end?
Well, that we don't know, but my guess is ultimately it has to end. This is not normal. But I think, you know, we've all survived by finding idiosyncratic opportunities.
Okay.
Just because markets really globally, particularly risk asset markets, are fully priced, you can still find opportunities in fully priced markets.
Jamie Dimon, Wes Edens, Mark Lazary, thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
Continuing to follow the news out of the Korean Peninsula, the UN Security Council scheduled to meet at 3 o'clock this afternoon here in New York to discuss the situation there as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calls for more action against that rogue regime. Our next guest, without question, the interview of the show, Ambassador Christopher Hill joins us now on our phone lines. A distinguished career in public service in the government. He was most recently U.S. Ambassador to Iraq. Now he's the dean, as I said, of the Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. I should note he was an ambassador to the Republic of Korea as well and a participant in the six-party talks on the North Korean nuclear issue. Ambassador Hill, great to have you with us today. And the word of the day is inured. We've seen so many of these tests over the course of the year. Is each one different? What was different about the one that happened last night?
Well, at a certain point, you have to ask, you know, why are they testing every week or so? Because clearly it's more than just, you know, to check the flight path. And I think what they're really doing is kind of an in-your-face move. They're trying to say, first of all, we're in full production with these things. So clearly they don't have to hand make them every test. I mean, they've got some production line. And secondly, I think they're trying to make the point that we are a full-fledged nuclear power, and you're just going to have to deal with us as such. And the more we send up these missiles, the more the reality, in their view, will sink in. My own view is we cannot accept them as a nuclear power when we certainly cannot accept a situation where a country points possibly nuclear-tipped missiles at us, and we're going to have to step up our game.
You've lived this. You've watched the deliberations of the UN Security Council. We certainly saw some heated ones on Monday. The U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, wanted more severe sanctions yet placed on North Korea with regard to oil. That didn't happen because of China in particular. What do you think is going to happen next? I'm going to steal a question that Tom asked a little earlier on the show. That is, what more can the UN do at this point?
Well, I think clearly the Chinese are going to have to do more. I mean, it's not enough to say they're against it and sort of go along with these limited sanctions. They've really got to go the full distance. North Korea does not have refining capacity, and so I mean, it's amazing they have nuclear facilities but not an oil refinery. So I think China really needs to look at this critical issue of gasoline. But looking beyond that, I think the U.S. and China really need to look at what going to do about this, and it's more than sanctions, because the sanctions train just moves too slowly compared to the nuclearization train. And so I think we do need to look at some options, and I think we need to make China understand that we're going to have no choice but to go forward.
To borrow a line from the musical Hamilton, you've been in the room where it happens. You were part of these six-party talks on North Korea. Very few people have been engaged in direct diplomacy with the North Korean regime. What's that like, and is it likely to be different now? If at some point in the near future we see all these parties returning to talk to each other one again, what are the particular complexities of dealing diplomatically with North Korea?
Well, first of all, these people are not stupid. They're not robots. They're not just reading from talking points. They're making their case. So, you know, you're up against people who know what they're talking about. But I think it's important to understand that when you talk to these negotiators, you're basically talking to the note taker, because the note taker is going to take the message back to Pyongyang. And we've not really had any kind of capacity to take a message to Pyongyang. I want to emphasize, however, that the North Koreans have shown no interest, zero interest in a getting back to the original purpose of these talks, which was denuclearization.
Right.
Instead, they've talked about the need to have kind of some kind of limits, and I don't think we should go that way. I think we should really press the Chinese and work together with China on this.
If you're just joining us, folks, Christopher Hill with us, as David and I both agree, this is without question the interview of the day for Bloomberg Surveillance. Ambassador Hill, I want to go through a little bit of the path here from Moses Brown in Providence to Bowdoin to your continued public service as ambassadors to different areas, your work critically in Kosovo and then on to Eastern Europe and Poland, and then your expertise on Asia. You more than anyone we speak to understands the trenches of the State Department. How destroyed is the State Department from the actions of the president with Secretary Tillerson?
Well, to put it gently, I think there's a problem. Diplomacy does, after all, need some diplomats, and it's worrisome to see many of the better ones, some of the best ones, leaving. I think Secretary Tillerson has really tried to address some of the main issues, but it's a bit of a team sport, and I don't think the Secretary of State can do it alone. And I think he needs to understand the role of the Secretary of State should be someone who comes in the ninth inning and shuts down a problem rather than shows up in the third inning and encourages parties to keep on talking or something. So I think there's a kind of a failure to understand the sort of technology of it all, of how, why you have lower-ranked mm-hmm. people, why you have middle-ranked people. And I think there's a failure to understand that these are career people who have a heck of a lot to offer. There, you know, when Secretary Tillerson showed up at the State Department in February, there wasn't one person there at the C Street entrance who wanted anything but full success for him. And instead, he's gotten involved in this issue of reforming the State Department. Look, that's a good idea. I think everything needs to be reformed, but my goodness, we have far more urgent matters out there in the world than having some accounting firm look at how the State Department is organized.
Okay, we've got all sorts of news flow here. Ambassador, one more question, if I could. Yeah. One of the few things you have and I have in common, besides the view of the athletic fields of Moses Brown, is we really are concerned about Aaron Judge. The ball he hit last night for the New York Yankees in Fenway Park, Chris, it would have gone over the turnpike, probably would have landed across the Charles River. What are the Red Sox going to do about the surging, dreaded New York Yankees?
I think they need to pitch him high and away and make him bite on sliders as well. I mean, I'm not really sure, but you're absolutely right. We've got to deal with that problem.
It is a true national problem.
Yeah.
Chris Hill, thank you. Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you in our Washington and New York studios.
Yes.
He's now, David, is this correct, with the University of Denver,
He's
right?
at the University of Denver, yeah. heading up the Corbell School of International Studies there, a fine and growing program there, and always incredibly great to talk to him about this issue in particular, and we've talked about the Middle East as well.
Legendary stories of carrying the Red Sox flag across all of Asia. Like, he's been known to go into meetings with swag and gifts.
That reminds me of Megan Green with her
yes.
Red Sox socks that she
yes.
will.
Tell our audience, Dave, in the time we've got left. We're waiting for some things to happen here. Our team is working on it right now. David, why, when we say that's the most important interview of the day, to me, it's the guy's experience. He's in the trenches.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I want to highlight again, and I did it in the question to him there about diplomacy, is that he lived this as the ambassador to South Korea. And then as a part of those talks, many years ago now, we were engaging with North Korea diplomatically with a few other countries in the region. I think it's just extraordinary to think about how few people have been in a boardroom, seated yeah. around a table, having occasion to exchange words with representatives of the North Korean government. Ambassador Christopher Hill, as you said, at the University of Denver, one of those few.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.